Welcome. Thank you for coming so early on a Saturday morning. Thank you for coming. My name is Jennifer Fraser, and this session is entitled Rome, Sweet Rome, Ancient Lessons in Design. And this presentation is an exploration I undertook to see what I could learn about interaction design by examining a seminal text on architecture. Just to give you a sense of what I'm going to talk about for the next 40 minutes, I'm going to start by talking a little bit about architecture and interaction design and the relationship that I see between the two. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about Vitruvius, who he was, what he did, and what he wrote. Then I'm going to introduce the three terms of fermitas, utilitas, and venustas. I'm going to talk about these aspirational terms in terms of what I think they meant when Vitruvius wrote them, and how I think they can apply to interaction design today. So I'm going to start by talking about each of these three terms separately, and then I'm going to close by talking about the three terms collectively. That should take about 40 minutes, and it'll leave us some time for questions at the end. So what does architecture have to do with interaction design? Well, usually when I come to a conference like this, sometimes the question comes up, well, what did you do before you were an interaction designer? And that's because those of us who've been doing it for a while generally have come to it from something else, just as I'm sure many of you come from a myriad of different backgrounds. And this is because interaction design is a relatively new design profession. So when people ask me, what have I been doing before I became an interaction designer, I generally tell them my background's in architecture. But then I qualify it by saying building architecture, because otherwise people assume that I was like some kind of software architect or something like that. So the next question I usually get is, how did you go from designing a building to designing interfaces? Because people generally assume the two aren't at all related. But then I get to explain to them the similarities between the two. And before I do that, I want to explain that I'm not trying to say that I think that architects make the best interaction designers. I'm merely speaking as someone from my own observations who's lived in both worlds, just as I'm sure many of you could draw parallels between your past jobs and experiences to what you do in your current jobs. So how do I see these two professions as being similar? Well, whether designing a product or designing a building, you do a lot of work to understand the needs of your clients, and then you do what you can to best meet their needs in your design. Whether designing a building or designing an interface, you're dealing with issues of place, navigation, orientation, and wayfinding. It's just that the materials and the conventions are different. And as an architect, you represent the voice of the customer, and you're constantly advocating, negotiating with the various engineers, contractors, subcontractors, as the building is both being designed and built, to ensure that decisions are being made that will best meet the needs of the customer. Well, the same thing happens when you're designing a product. It's just that the players are different. Sorry. Instead of engineers and architects, Instead of engineers and contractors, it's product managers and development team you're negotiating with. And this relationship between architecture and interaction design was further reinforced for me last year when I was at South by Southwest. I attended a talk by Dan Saffer entitled Learning from Las Vegas. Now, this is a book I fondly remembered from my early years in architecture school. So it got me thinking about some of the other books I'd read when I was in architecture school and trying to think what, if any, connection they had to interaction design. But which book to choose? Well, as I mentioned, interaction design as an established design profession is still in its infancy, especially when you compare it to a profession like architecture. And since it is so new, who interaction designers are and what they do is still in many ways being defined. So, as a source of inspiration for this talk, I decided to go back to the beginning in a sense, to see what insights could be gained for what we do from a book that's been around for centuries. So I chose The 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. But before I talk about the book, I wanted to explain a little bit about Vitruvius. So who was he? Well, he was an ancient Roman. He lived about 2,000 years ago. He was born sometime between 80 and 70 BC, and he died around 20 BC. And in reading about him, you'll see him referred to as both an architect and an engineer. That's in part because in ancient Rome, there isn't the same distinction as there is today between those two professions. Today, there are very clear legal definitions that articulate the roles and accountabilities of each of these very distinct professions. Instead, in ancient Rome, the role of the architect included today's equivalent of the architect, the engineer, the artist, the craftsman, and the landscape architect. Vitruvius's patron was this guy, Emperor Caesar Augustus. And Vitruvius doesn't appear to have designed many buildings, so instead, the Caesar paid him to write. In fact, there's only one building that we know about that Vitruvius designed. And the only reason we know about it is because he wrote about it in his own book. And it was a basilica, or Roman public building, in Fanum Fortunae, which is now the town of Fano. There are no remains of this basilica, and no one even knows where within the town it had been built. So since he had designed only one building that we know of, Vitruvius is not famous for what he designed. Instead, he is famous for what he wrote. So as I mentioned, he's the author of De Architectura, which is the only major book on architecture from classical antiquity. And today it's known as the Ten Books on Architecture. Scholars have decided that Vitruvius wrote this treatise between 27 and 23 BC, and he dedicated it to his patron, Caesar Augustus. But Vitruvius's work was largely unknown until it was rediscovered by this person, Poggio Bracciolini. He found a medieval copy of the manuscript in 1414 in an abbey in St. Gallen, Switzerland. Poggio was interested in classical texts and was traveling around looking for medieval manuscripts that he would translate from Latin. After finding a copy of Vitruvius's work, similar to this one, this is a medieval copy from the 800s, he then translated it and publicized the manuscript, and it was quite well received by the Renaissance thinkers of the time, who had an interest in classical and scientific heritage. The word Renaissance, or rebirth, was a time when classical ideals were being reapplied to various aspects of society. So this is when Vitruvius's work really took off and became well known, and they're still well known to this day. As the title implies, Vitruvius's book is divided into 10 books. Each of these books is then further subdivided into different sections and chapters. As you can see, in these 10 books, he covers a range of topics from symmetry and temples in the human body to very pragmatic topics, such as finishes for floors and walls. And one of the things Vitruvius writes about in book 3 is human proportions and how the different proportions of the various parts of the human body relate to each other. And these observations were later codified in a very famous drawing by Leonardo da Vinci. So many people are famous with this iconic drawing of the Vitruvian Man, but they don't realize where it comes from is Vitruvius's writings in the 10 Books on Architecture. But of all the things he wrote about in his book, Vitruvius is most famous, at least among architects, for something he wrote in Book 1. After describing various types of architecture and building, he wrote this. Or, as translated by Morris Hickey Morgan, all these must be built with due reference to durability, convenience, and beauty. Now, as I mentioned, Vitruvius wasn't much of a practitioner of architecture. Instead, he was more of a writer about architecture. So we can see these three terms as being somewhat aspirational in nature for architects. Vitruvius then goes on to explain each of these terms in detail, and we will look at them each of them individually. So we'll start by talking about firmitas, or durability. And what does Vitruvius write about durability? Well, he goes on to explain, durability will be assured when foundations are carried down to the solid ground and materials wisely and liberally selected. So there's two aspects he's describing here that need to be placed to ensure durability. The ground upon which the foundation is built needs to be solid, and the materials wisely and liberally selected. In other words, the foundation needs to be designed and constructed to support the building. So let's talk about this one first. This image is a Renaissance illustration from a 1521 version of Vitruvius's book. Vitruvius has two chapters in this book dedicated to the discussion of foundations. And in the chapter on foundations for domestic buildings, he writes about the need to have the foundation walls of underground rooms thicker than the walls above them to ensure that the walls above had solid bearing as you can see in this drawing, or as you can see in this picture of a Roman foundation. So what does that mean to us today? Well, we can think of the foundation as the code base of the application for which we are designing, because essentially it is the code, so the underlying structure for all the interactions that we're designing. If you're lucky enough to work on a 1.0 version of a product, well, this code base or foundation is newly constructed. It's like designing a new building on an empty site. The design of this new foundation is under the purview of the development team and will, at least in theory, be designed to appropriately carry the load, so to speak, of the new interactions that you're designing. When designing a building, the architect gives very detailed drawings of the building to the civil engineer, so the civil engineer can appropriately design the foundation for it. So just as the architect communicates the design of the building to the civil engineer, is the accountability of the interaction designers to ensure that the development team knows what interactions we need the code base or the foundation to support. And they need to know what interactions need to be supported, both in the short and the long term, so they can design and construct a code base that will meet both the short and the long-term needs of the application. But if you're not working on a 1.0 version of a product, then that's when things get more interesting, because then you're having to work with a pre-existing code base or a foundation. For those of you not familiar with this building, this is the Winchester House. It was the home of Sarah Winchester, and she was the widow of the gun magnate William Winchester. She was saddened by the death of her husband and her child years earlier, so she went and consulted a medium. And the medium told her that she was being haunted by the ghosts of all the people that had ever been killed by a Winchester rifle, and that she had to keep building her house, or she would die. So, without a master plan, her house was under continuous construction for 38 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, without a master plan. So this could be what the underlying code for your application or website looks like. The design and renovation of an existing product or foundation is still under the purview of the development team, but just as in a 1.0 product, it's the accountability of the interaction designers to ensure that the development team understands what addition the code base needs to support in order to meet the needs of the people for whom we are designing. At the same time, it's the development team's accountability to know what needs to be done to ensure that the code base will continue to be technically viable, or to use the building metaphor, will continue to be structurally sound. As designers, we may find out about some of the limitations, such as stairs to nowhere, the existing code base, when we try to design things but find out that the existing code base, that they cannot be supported by the existing code base or foundation. And this is when the negotiation inevitably begins between the different stakeholders on the project. And this is part of the fun challenge of working on legacy products or websites. So that was the first aspect of durability and how it applies to interaction design. I've summarized that as design a strong foundation. The second consideration in ensuring durability that Vitruvius wrote about was that the ground upon which the foundation is built must be solid. In Vitruvius's chapter on foundations and substructures for temples, he talks about the need to have the foundation on solid ground. And if there is no solid ground and nothing but loose earth, then the ground had to be dug up and wooden piles or posts made of wood must be driven into the ground. Just as this illustration shows Venetian workers driving wooden piles or posts into the ground, then the foundation is built upon these wooden piles or posts. So what does that mean to us today? Well, if the foundation of the application is the code base, then the ground upon which that foundation sits could be many things. It could be this, or it could be this, or it could be these. Or if you're a web-based designer, the ground upon which your foundation rests could be this, or it could be this, or it could be this. And any of those could be running on this, or this, are one of these. Or if you're designing plugins or web-based applications, the ground could be this. And that could be running in that, or it could be running in that, or it could be running on that. And in turn, those could be running on this, or this, or one of these. So now we're starting to have something that looks a whole lot like this, a house of cards. And even with automated testing, there are so many permutations, combinations, coexistence possibilities that I would argue that inevitably something is going to go wrong with someone trying to use what it is we have designed. So where does that leave us? Well, I think it leaves us in a place where we need to be able to fail gracefully. We need to fail in a way that's going to impact people as little as possible. So for example, I have this problem with my desktop system at work, where it just randomly shuts down. I'll be sitting there working, and all of a sudden my screens will just go black. So I have to get under my desk, manually restart my system, restart my applications, and the next time I launch Firefox, it asks me this: would I like to restore my last session? This makes me so phenomenally happy. So when I'm doing research, I'll have multiple windows open, multiple tabs open each of those windows, and having them prompt me with this next time I restart saves me so much time and effort. And even though it's a hardware problem, it's not even Firefox's problem, they've provided me with a graceful way to carry on from where I left off. So while it might seem contradictory to have durability associated with failing, I've summarized the second aspect as failing gracefully. So that covers the two aspects of durability. The next quality Vitruvius had mentioned was utilitas, or convenience. So how does he define convenience? Well, he writes, convenience, when the arrangement of the apartments is faultless and presents no hindrance to use, and when each class of building is assigned to its suitable and appropriate exposure. So again, there's two aspects here that he's talking about. First, that the design and layout presents no hindrance to use. And second, that the building is designed with suitable and appropriate exposure, whatever that means. So we'll start with this one. What does it mean to be designed with suitable and appropriate exposure? Well, in Book 6, Vitruvius writes about proper exposures of different rooms in a residential dwelling. For example, in ancient Rome, you never wanted to design a house with a south-facing library, because apparently you would end up with bookworms and mold in your books because of the damp southern wind. But to extend this idea of suitable and appropriate exposure beyond the relationship of rooms to the cardinal directions, in the next chapter, he writes about the delineation of spaces within the house between public and private areas. The private rooms, only for the people who own the house themselves, are those rooms into which nobody has the right to enter without invitation. Rooms such as bedrooms, dining rooms, and bathrooms. And the common rooms are those which any person apparently had a right to enter, even without an invitation. Rooms such as the entrance court, the atrium, or shops. So what does that mean to us today in relation to designing interactions? Well, in many situations, regardless of what type of application it is you're designing, notions of public and private and personal disclosure come into play. For example, there's the design and implementation of various levels of control that allow the customer to define what information they want to share with you about themselves and how they use your product, as well as what information they want to receive from you. Do you want to join the Microsoft Customer Experience Improvement Program? And by doing so, let them monitor how you're using their products so that they can make their software and services better? Well, the choice is yours. And it's our job as designers to make these choices manifest. Just as Vitruvius asked architects to consider the principles on which the public and private rooms in a building should be constructed, we too need to consider the principles and ethics that come into play when we are pulling information from the people for whom we are designing, or when we are pushing information to them. So that's the first aspect of convenience, attention to the delineation between public and private. The other aspect of convenience he mentioned was that the arrangement of rooms should present no hindrance to use. So how does that relate to designing interactions? Well, at a simplistic level, a well-designed interaction should present no hindrance to use. But to expand on this a bit more, specifically, what was Vitruvius writing about when he wrote this? Well, in Book 6, he writes about designing the house to suit the station of the owner. And the station was not simply meant to imply the social status, but it also talked about the functional requirements that the owner would have for the house. For example, someone whose business it was to sell produce would have stalls and shops in their house, and they also might have special storerooms constructed to keep the produce fresh. Or, shown in this example, a farmhouse would be designed with consideration to such things as the size of the oil pressing room in relation to what type of oil press they had to ensure that the oil press lever could be properly used. Vitruvius goes on to explain that if the houses are planned to suit these different stations of people and with what he refers to as propriety, then there would be no room for criticism of the building. He writes, "For they will be arranged with convenience and perfection to suit every purpose." And then he goes on to write about propriety. "The perfection of style, which comes when a work is authoritatively constructed on approved principles." So what kind of principles is he referring to? Well, the examples he gives are not mixing Doric and Ionic detailing on the same building. As you can see in this image, each of the classical orders had very specific proportions, profiles, and details associated with them. In this close-up, you can see the difference in detailing between Doric on the left and Ionic on the right. There's differences in the column capitals here, the column base, and then the cornice profile. So how does this relate to designing interactions? Well, just as an architect needs to design a building to take into account the functional requirements of its owner, we too must take into account the functional requirements of the people for whom we are designing. Right? Not rocket science. But further to that, Vitruvius suggests that architects follow established standards of design when, for example, designing something using the Doric order so as not to, to avoid spoiling the effect of the design. Just as today, there are conventions used within buildings to imply things such as navigation into and through a space, hierarchy of spaces within a building, there are also conventions in interaction design that can be leveraged to make it easier for the people for whom we are designing. Now, this isn't meant to imply that guidelines such as OS interface design standards must be strictly followed and adhered to. Instead, I'm suggesting that if you're designing for something that has an established vocabulary or conventions, to be aware of them. Because as a designer, we're accountable for making an informed decision as to whether we choose to abide by these established conventions or whether we choose to dismiss them. And we need to be aware of the impact that that choice is going to have on the people for whom we are designing. So I've summarized the second aspect of convenience as acknowledged conventions. The third and final quality that Vitruvius had mentioned was venustas, or beauty. And so how does Vitruvius define beauty? Well, he writes, "And beauty, when the appearance of the work is pleasing and in good taste, and when its members are in due proportion according to correct principles of symmetry." Well, we all know that beauty and good taste are very subjective terms. They're culturally specific, and they change with the passage of time. So what was Vitruvius writing about when he wrote about beauty? Well, as one of his six fundamental principles of architecture, he lists eurythmy, which he defines as beauty and fitness in the adjustment of the members. He goes on to write about the height of things suiting their breadth, and their breadth suiting the length, or having things corresponding symmetrically. But he also had symmetry listed as one of the six fundamental principles of architecture. So what was distinct between eurythmy and symmetry is this notion of fitness in the adjustment of members. So one example of this adjustment is in columns. As you can see in this image, the width of the column at the top is different from the width of the column at the bottom. And Vitruvius writes about the height of columns and how, depending on the height of the column, the proportional difference between the width of the column at the top and bottom will be different. And the term for this is called antasis. And this is just a word to describe a curve that's applied to a surface for aesthetic reasons. According to Vitruvius, this proportional difference in width between the top and the bottom would depend on the height of the column. So it'd be different if the column was 15 feet tall versus a column that's 40 feet tall. So why did they make this adjustment to column width? Well, Vitruvius writes, "The eye is always in search of beauty. If we do not gratify its desire for pleasure by proportionate enlargement in these measures, a clumsy and awkward appearance will be presented to the beholder." So to paraphrase, I would suggest that the goal of these adjustments was to remove visual distraction and compensate for things that might otherwise be jarring to the eye. So how does that apply to us today? Well, one example could be the interface of Adobe's Lightroom. The majority of the interface has been muted to allow the photographer's eye to focus on what's important on the screen, and that is the minute changes in color of the image on which they're working. The extraneous visual noise and clutter of the interface has been reduced by applying a gray palette to it, allowing the eye to focus on the color of the central image. At the recent IXDA conference in Savannah, I heard Dave Cronin from Cooper talking about designing for flow. And he was talking about how athletes and musicians talk about being in the flow of the moment. I think this is what this interface encourages, the idea of flow and promoting focus on what's important in the moment. I think another example of this, whether you love or hate Microsoft and the ribbon, is the Microsoft Office 2007 mini bar. The mini toolbar appears when you have selected text. It is semi-transparent, and it does not become opaque unless you move your cursor towards it. And after it appears, if you don't use it, it eventually just fades away. I see this as an extension of the same principle, in that the mini toolbar appears in place where you have selected the text, so the eye doesn't have to search the screen to find the tools you're looking for in the myriad of tools available on the ribbon. Provides the minimum set of tools that you need at your cursor point when you need them. As well, it appears in a translucent state, which is less visually jarring than having an opaque dialog or toolbar, suddenly appear on your document. So I've summarized this interpretation of beauty, as opposed to interaction design, as fostering focus, or as Dave Cronin would say, promoting the flow. So now we have looked at all three qualities in isolation. But Vitruvius had written that a well-designed building had to include all three of these qualities. So let's look at them together. When I first started doing research for this presentation, I came across a few references talking about the similarity between Vitruvius's three qualities of durability, convenience, and beauty, with the three qualities for a successful product that Liz Sanders had written about in the early 90s, which were usable, useful, and desirable. And I started looking at the two sets of qualities, seeing how they related, how they might overlap, but that's not really what I wanted to focus on. So instead, I went back to the three Vitruvian qualities, which I've explained were somewhat aspirational in nature, because Vitruvius wrote more about architecture than he actually practiced. We've already discussed how individually each of these three are still relevant today when designing products. As I said, durability provides a solid, extensible foundation for the current and future needs of the product. Convenience ensures the product will meet the needs of the people for whom we are designing and will allow them to easily achieve their goals. And beauty provides a product that will appeal to the aesthetic of the target market and provide an environment that will not visually distract them from achieving their goals. And if individually these three aspirational qualities are still relevant, how can we use the three of them together? If Vitruvius wanted architects to aspire to have all three of these aspects in a well-designed building, could the three of them together be used to measure where your product is in relation to these and where you aspire it to be? Now, these three aspects can easily come into conflict during a development cycle, as people accountable for each of these aspects try to pull the product towards themselves at the expense of the other. To work this out, there will need to be discussion, mediation, and compromise between the stakeholders on any given product, or even at a feature level within a product, you can see this tension occurring. As well, forces external to the product can also come into play to apply pressure on where the product resides within this matrix. Pressures such as strategic requirements, resource constraints, customer perception. To speak a little bit more about perception, the perceptions of stakeholders both internally and externally will affect which aspect of these three that they see as most desirable within the product. For example, I know that when I look at buying a car, the aspects that I personally consider most important would be very different from my gearhead coworker. And that is why it's important to ensure that all three aspects are considered and in harmony in a well-designed product. And that as designers, we are mindful and communicate to the stakeholders the impact of emphasis on any one aspect at the expense of the others. Now, this is not meant to imply that you always want every product to be an equal mix of each of these three qualities. As I mentioned, internal and external requirements will determine where the final product ends up within this matrix. Instead, I'm suggesting that these aspirational qualities could provide us with a way for understanding where we are with the product and where we aspire to be. For example, if we are creating a prototype of something, depending on the goal for the prototype might reside somewhere around here. So you create something that maybe looks fairly good, some of the features work fairly well on it, but it's not that durable because it's only a prototype. And using these three aspects, it provides the way to understand where we are with the current prototype and where we aspire to be with the final product. In closing, I want to return to one last quote. I promise this is the last one, from Vitruvius. In this quote, he is writing about who will be congratulated when different aspects of a building are the most prominent. And for me, this quote emphasizes the notion that even though one aspect of a product may stand out more than the others, all three aspects need to be considered and in harmony in a well-designed product. So he writes, "Consequently, the question of approving any work may be considered under three heads, that is, delicacy of workmanship, sumptuousness, and design." So he's talking about the three aspects by which a building will be evaluated. And while he isn't using the terms durability, convenience, and beauty, the ones he's using are somewhat similar. He then goes on to explain who will be praised for each aspect of the work when that aspect is the one that is the most outstanding. When a work has been carried out sumptuously, the owner will be praised. When delicately, the workman will be praised. And when proportion and symmetry are the most outstanding, the architect will be praised. So using terms similar to durability, convenience, and beauty, he was writing about this idea that while one aspect of a building or product may stand out, all three need to be considered and be in harmony in a well-designed product. The beginning of this presentation, I mentioned that one of the reasons I chose Vitruvius' book for this exploration was because of the relative infancy of interaction design as an established design profession. But if explorations like this one can help us find parallels with longer-standing design professions, then those parallels can be leveraged to help us as we define who we are and what we do. And I invite all of you, with your diverse backgrounds, to undertake similar explorations within your own areas of expertise, to see what insights you can gain that will help inform who we are and what we do. Thank you. Are there any questions? No, but I could make it available. I'm not sure if I understand your question, sorry. Okay. I come from the land of desktop software applications. So I was referring to working quite closely with the development team throughout the even early brainstorming of kind of solutions within a product, because they are the ones who understand the architecture of the existing code base, and they know where its kind of limitations are. So as we start thinking about a solution, they know whether or not the current architecture is in place to support that type of interaction, or if they need to start researching and doing work on their side to kind of enhance or shore up the what's there to kind of deliver what we're expecting as we're designing the feature functionality within the product. So it's a constant communication throughout the development cycle. So the question was, what pillars do we use when doing customer research? The pillars in a way could be just different methods and a variety of methods that we use. So depending on the timelines for the product and what you're dealing with, I mean, in an ideal solution, in the ideal situation, would be everything from surveys to phone interviews to contextual job shadowing to see what it is they're having problems with. And in terms of a legacy product, I mean, it makes it a bit easier because you can actually sit there and watch them using your product and see what problems, and it's just become so evident. As well with a legacy product, there's also things that you didn't have a chance to address in the previous version that you know are still of utmost importance to the customer. But getting out there and finding out whether or not it's still the case is key. Did that answer your question? And the thing is, those activities can occur at any point in a development cycle. So it's just a question of having a pool of people available you to contact throughout development cycle. You can start getting ideas or guidance on where you need to be going in future iterations of the product. Dan? He does to the extent, and I was really surprised to find the example in the Utilitas section where he actually, well, obviously it's a translation because I don't read Latin, but according to this Morris Hickey Morgan translation, he actually speaks of functional requirements, which I wasn't expecting to find in like a 2,000-year-old text. He doesn't talk about what methods he uses to garner those that understanding, but it is there as something specifically that an architect needs to do. And from my own experience in architecture, I would have to agree. I think that they could learn a lot about the methods that we use to understand our customer needs, because I think that is an area that's missing today in contemporary architecture, and they could learn a lot from interaction design in that regard. Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that Vitruvius doesn't talk about at all. I mean, because example I gave about the farmhouse, he talks about making sure that the oil pressing room is designed to fit depending on the type of oil pressing machine that's there, but doesn't really talk about what happens if the farmer goes out and buys a different one. So it's something he doesn't deal with or cover at all in the book. Mm-hmm. It does. And part of the, it's terrifying what you see people doing sometimes with the product. Terrifying in terms of it's excruciating. Just crazy things people are doing that there's functionality to help them do it. Like for any of the designers in the room, there's people that are creating like manual separations of color. Like people are doing this manually when you can actually, there's an automated way of creating separations of your graphics. And so to see people doing these really laborious tasks where there's a really simple way of doing it within the application, well, obviously that simple way is not evident or easily for them to find within the product. So there's so many things you learn from watching them. And also another thing, many people just, well, with CorelDRAW graphics, they would just upgrade every other version. So there's a whole version of features and functionality that they're simply not aware of, because none of the collateral in the product talks about what was new last version, right? It's all focused on what's new this version. So there's different things that we did to try and make it more discoverable for people, now that we could take into account that, okay, they've missed the last version of the product, chances are. So what can we do to help them find stuff that's in there that's going to help them make their job easier? Yeah, and part of it is tutorials and getting very focused, knowing the types of people that are using the product, having very focused, to call them like insights from the experts that kind of take them through a typical workflow. And also we implemented something that was called hints. So something that was tried to appeal to both legacy users of the product as well as new users in terms of just tips or tricks about using a certain feature that some power users would know about these tricks, but to make it more evident for people that were new, but not in a way that would still give information to even longtime power users of the product. Okay. Did everybody hear the question? It's about specificity in building. I'm just trying to think for a moment to see if Vitruvius really spoke about that. Nothing's coming to mind, but I can, when I was thinking about the kind of idea of promoting flow when you're working on an application, in the example of Adobe Lightroom, I mean, that's a really focused environment that's distinct and different from Photoshop. And I mean, you can see that with a lot of applications today, especially the web-based ones. They're just offering people a subset of tools that are in things like Microsoft Word, for example, because it's just so overcrowded with things that you kind of lose that ability to just focus on a very specific task and have just the tools you need to focus and do that task and do it well and easily. So while Vitruvius doesn't really talk about it, I mean, you can really clearly see it as a trend in application design today. Is that it? Well, thank you very much for coming.